Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today's episode is brought to you by Pluto TV. Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed. No sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today.
Welcome into another edition of Beyond the Darkness, Sunday edition. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader, and we continue this weekend with our tribute shows to Stanton Friedman. Unfortunately, he passed away this past Monday, coming back from a speaking engagement in Columbus, Ohio. He passed away suddenly at the Toronto Pearson Airport on Monday night, that according to his family. We wanted to pay special attention to Stanton Friedman, of course, a pioneer in the ufology field, a very good friend, a very good guest here on Beyond the Darkness, and our forefather to Beyond the Darkness, Darkness Radio. Stanton really was very giving of his time with us, and very giving not only of his time to us, but very giving to his time to other shows, to other podcasts, to other radio shows, and very giving to the audience of those shows. If you ever ran into Stanton at a convention of any sort, Stanton was very giving of his time, especially if you had a passion for ufology or had ever looked up at the stars and wondered if there was anything there. Stanton certainly wanted to talk theory with you and what it was you believed in, not necessarily what he believed in, but what you believed in. And he just had this inquiring mind that was absolutely brilliant and wonderful. And it was great to sit and talk with Stanton. Today's show is an absolutely fascinating one at that. And the show that we're going to talk about today is one that was one of my favorites. Unfortunately, I wasn't there for this show. This show is back from 2010, but was in very capable hands, as Dave had his co-host Mally Fox with him at this time. The show had to do with science, actually. It was a book that Stanton had wrote at the time with Kathleen Martin, and it was called Science Was Wrong. And it was a very fascinating conversation. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you 2 hours of this show. One aired on one night, the other aired on another night. The next night, as a matter of fact, Stanton was on 1 hour of the show. Kathleen was on another hour of the show. We're going to put them together today. You're going to hear the culmination of the 2 hours together for today. So you hear Stanton first, and then you'll hear Kathleen second. And the way the book went, proof science was wrong, the way that this book went was that Stanton wrote 7 chapters, Kathleen wrote 7 chapters of this book, and it's a fascinating book. The two of them got together and wrote the book together, and just put out this book, Proof Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and inventions they declared impossible. So lots of good stuff about this book, and that book is still out there for you to purchase. So without further ado, let's get to it, and let's hear the voice of Stanton Friedman first, telling us about this fascinating book, along with Dave Schrader and Mally Fox. It's all coming up right now on Sunday's edition of Beyond the Darkness.
Good evening and welcome. It's Tuesday night. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, Mally Fox. Good evening, Mally.
Good evening.
Now, we got a great show lined up tonight. You know, you weren't here when we did the first interview with our next guest and talked to him about Roswell and about UFOs and amazing guy. Very interesting. And he's got a new book out that he's co-written with Kathleen Marden. And this evening, we're going to speak with him. Science Was Wrong.
Oh,
is the name of the book. So I always love when people can challenge science and show us what's going on in the real world, all these crazy twists that we think we know, and we only find out we only thought we knew what we knew what we know, something along those lines. Stanton Friedman joins us this evening. He was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist by major industrial companies working in highly advanced classified nuclear programs. He's the author of Flying Saucers and Science, and he's the co-author of Captured. Friedman has appeared on hundreds of radio and TV programs, including four times on Larry King Live, and now for his second appearance on Darkness Radio. Please welcome back to the show, Mr. Stanton Friedman. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, indeed.
Thank you very much for joining us.
I'm in beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada.
Now, you know, I've got to get up to Canada more. I've been up there twice, and I feel so cheated because both of them were directly over the border. I don't think I was over the Canada border more than about 200 feet, and that's about my...
Was it to say you were in Canada?
No, I went to Victoria, Canada, to some haunted hotel.
Okay.
But, like, literally, you got off the ferry, and there was the hotel. And then I went to Sarnia, Canada, to...
Ontario, yeah.
Yeah, to do some a paranormal convention with Robbie Thomas last year, and it's like you drive over from Detroit, you drive over the bridge, and the hotel was on the other side of the bridge. So both times I made it about, you know, 150 yards into Canada, and maybe that's by purpose. They were afraid to have me there. But it's great to have you back on the show. I mean, certainly you've got some amazing insights. In this book, I just got it in from the publisher, Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. And just, I mean, there's a lot of strange topics that go on in here. And now, we talked to you in the past, and of course, UFOs is what everybody always associates you with, and especially the work with Roswell and doing that. Yeah, I mean, you've got such an impressive resume here, too, as I just look through the about the author sheet that they've given to me. If I just read this alone, I'd be out of a show already this evening, Mal. You've done so much. What got you involved in this book, and how did you start stumbling upon these different secrets and facts that science was so off base from what we know of it?
Well, as a nuclear physicist who's had wide interest, I did a weekly science commentary for the local CBC radio station way back in the 80s. So I read all kinds of stuff. And working on UFOs as long and hard as I have, I found often that the real stumbling blocks were the fact that highly educated, very respectable people had often said very stupid things that stood in the way of, with regard to UFOs, not only the overall picture, you know, there is no evidence, they'd say, not having referred to any of the many large-scale scientific studies that they should have before they opened their mouth, but they also, it was aggravating. There's a whole tone about what they were saying. Don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up. And because I worked on really far-out technology, nuclear airplanes, fission nuclear rockets, fusion nuclear rockets, nuclear power plants for space, and stuff like that, I realized that it wasn't just in these areas that scientists have stuck their nose in where it didn't belong because of their ignorance. I mean, everybody's entitled to an opinion, it says here, but if you're going to pose as a professional, that opinion requires knowledge, requires some ethics, how dare you say there is no evidence if you haven't looked for it, you know, that kind of thing. And Kathleen and I had worked together on Captured, of course, and that came out in 2007. She's Betty Hill's niece. She did most of the work. She had most of the information, but I had met Betty and Barney and so forth. And I was the heavy. I took on the nasty, noisy negativists about the case. I don't mind playing the hitman, you know.
Sure.
But, and after I did Flying Saucers and Science, which has a whole chapter on you can get here from there and looking at the technology things, we were talking about, you know, maybe we should get into other areas here. Kathy has very strong interest in medical stuff, the book has 14 chapters, and she wrote 7, and I wrote 7. Rather than, you know, both of us working together, we don't live close to each other, so that's a little more difficult than, you know, let's go down the street and we'll go over this chapter.
Right.
Well, send a PDF file and wait a while. kind of thing. So we found that our interests matched up nicely, and there are important lessons here. You know, there are whole books, I've got one around here someplace, about the stupid things said by smart people, you know. But that isn't the point of this book. The point is that we need to look at the situations in which there are consequences. In other words, if progress is delayed, a lot of people might die. You know, the story of Ignaz Semmelweis, one of my favorite characters in Truth, Not Fiction, a medical doctor who was an expert, gynecologist we'd call him today, or obstetrician. Anyway, he was working in a big hospital in Vienna way back in 1840 or so, and was smart enough to recognize that, son of a gun, how come the women who were being delivered at this huge lying-in hospital by midwives, only 2% of them developed childbed fever, which was almost invariably fatal. No antibiotics back then, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And when you looked at the other side of the hospital, where the women were being delivered by residents and doctors, it was 20%. And to make a long story short, you got to read the book, of course, but the whole point was that it turns out that he instituted new rules to try to get that 20% down to 2%. Mainly, these guys were doing autopsies upstairs before coming downstairs to examine pregnant women and to deliver.
Oh.
And there was a little kicker here. There was no rule to wash your hands. They'd wipe their hands on their bloody aprons. The mark of a good doctor was how bloody his apron was. And so they were spreading, I'll call them bacteria, germs, bad stuff.
Sure.
From the dead ones to the live ones. And he instituted strong measures and published some papers and stuff. And the big thing was washing hands with a strong soap. And, you know, changing the linens more than once a month. What?
And he had to write a big paper on that?
Well, he wrote several papers.
Right.
And it, for his troubles, he wound up being kicked out of the hospital, forced out of the hospital by the director because he was, this wasn't the way we did things here. We know what we're doing. How dare you challenge authority on this matter? He wasn't that old when this happened. And so he was forced out of the hospital. And it was years before they returned to doing things right. The germ theory finally got accepted, Pasteur and Jenner and other people. But the thing was, his evidence was good, his papers were good, he had the data, and don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up.
Mm.
It's a classic case. I eventually issued a stamp in his honor, you know, like that did the women who died a lot of good.
Sure.
but that was typical of the situations. A smallpox, there were people fighting against vaccination and variolation and stuff like that. And smallpox was a real bad disease. At times it hit a third of the population and killed almost all of them. And the goods were there to show that vaccination would work and prevent, greatly reduce, let's say. Yeah, the thing in medicine, of course, is you never get 100% anything.
Right.
You know, some people are allergic to penicillin, it'll kill them, it won't cure them, you know.
Sure.
But, and that's why doctors have, you know, 6 different medications for high blood pressure, for example, because some don't work for some people, and others work for other people, you know. And this was an area that was particularly interesting because of the consequences. And also, to me personally, although Kathy wrote the chapter on eugenics, you know, people think of the Nazis were the guys who were saying wanting to master race and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They picked it up from the Americans in this country. Well, I'm a dual citizen, so I can complain about both governments.
Sure.
Legally, you know. But they the whole idea we should only let the finest reproduce. Fitness was the thing. Taller, stronger, and there were contests at state fairs and stuff like that, and there were consequences. Laws actually got passed in some places that you could sterilize people who came from unfit to reproduce backgrounds. If somebody in the family was inadequate, maybe deaf for goodness sakes, we could sterilize the rest of the people in the family.
Wow.
I mean, you know, it's a very sad tale, but it's a cautionary tale because it was applied. The money was supplied by the Rockefellers and the Harrimans and other rich groups, and the Nazis picked right up on that eugenics movement. And so, and the reason it got to me is all my grandparents would have been rejected as unfit because they came over not speaking English from Eastern Europe, and these guys would give IQ tests in English to people who couldn't speak English.
Sure.
And obviously unfit, you know, send them back. Things like that are distressing. Now, on my side of the fence, I got a kick out of the aviation stuff, and I quote people like Dr. Simon Newcomb, who was the top American astronomer of the 19th century. As a matter of fact, he was such a prominent man that his funeral in 1909 was attended by the President of the United States.
Wow.
And he made a strong statement in 1903, October, and the date's significant, that all the data indicates man will never fly in a powered vehicle. It's a much longer, more complicated statement. That was less than 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. Now, he was a competent astronomer. He didn't know anything about flight, aircraft.
Right.
The Wright brothers were bicycle mechanics, but they had built their own wind tunnel. They ran all kinds of calculations and measurements to try to get the two together. I mean, what good's a calculation if it doesn't match what you measure, you know? And the thing is that his attitude kept many people from investing in aviation. As a matter of fact, the Wright brothers got turned down twice when they applied for a grant. And they finally did get a grant, and I get a kick out of the fact that there was a kicker in the contract. They would get a bonus if the plane went faster than 40 miles an hour, honest. And it went 47, so they got a $5,000 bonus, which in 1908 or so
right.
was a lot of money.
Sure is. Know?
But that was just the beginning of some of the stupidity about flight. All kinds of impossible. We call them the impossibilists in the book. The original title of the book is "It's Impossible, Isn't It?"
Well,
but the publisher, publisher changed it to "Science Was Wrong," and publishers have the right to change the title.
Right. Well, I was curious. Now, going back to some of the medical things, when you know, I understand that there, sometimes you have very smart people in their segment, and then they get questioned about something they know nothing about. And like you were just mentioning about the fact saying, oh, no, flight's just not going to happen. Meanwhile, two bicycle guys are working on a firm method to get us into flight. With the medical issues, though, why do you think it was, you know, just kind of throwing logic out the window? I mean, in medicine, the whole idea was to make things better, to look at the facts and try to help people.
Well,
why do you think that they wiped stuff away so easily and were so blindsided by, well, it possibly can't be we're carrying one? They knew how disease was transferred, didn't they?
No, they didn't.
Right,
that was the whole thing about Semmelweis, is they didn't know how it was. It was from miasmas, vapors from swamps, all kinds of things. Honest to God, I mean, and there's a common factor that runs through all of these, I guess, is arrogance and ignorance. You know, the guy who discovered penicillin, here's a petri dish and there's no bacteria there. I mean, something's wrong. And he could have thrown out the dish. Well, we did something wrong. Don't worry about it. But he got curious, and why is that, I wonder? You know, the wonderment. So the factors are arrogance and ignorance. In other words, there's a kind of attitude that says, look, I'm a very smart guy, and I keep up with what's important. And with regard to UFOs, for example, if aliens were visiting Earth and the government was covering up, that'd be a big story. Nobody denies that. But if it were a big story, I would know about it because I'm so smart. And I don't, so it must not be. And I'm not going to waste my time chasing down this foolishness. And so you run into that in a whole bunch of areas. And also, there tends to be a kind of insistence on knowing all the answers. For example, back in the 20s, pernicious anemia was invariably fatal. So guys tried a lot of experiments in which you could produce pernicious anemia in dogs. And they tried feeding them all kinds of stuff. And son of a gun, the ones who got liver lived and did fine. So pretty soon they were feeding people liver. Now, it worked, but there was a little problem. What the heck was it in the liver that was doing the good?
Right.
It took a lot of years before they found that it was vitamin B12, because the amounts involved are trivial. Micrograms, millionths of a gram. And the thing is, the pragmatist says, look, I don't need to know how. It would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
That would simplify things. But like the British Navy, the Navy guys were called limeys. Why? Because the Britons found that by providing limes to the sailors, they didn't get the disease that you get when you don't have enough vitamin C. They didn't know anything about vitamin C. Scurvy is the disease. But it worked. And it was a long time before vitamin C was discovered. They said, look, our objective here is to have a fighting Navy. And that means the guy's got to be healthy. Scurvy is not a pleasant disease. And so this works. Let's use it. And it was a long time before they found out, you know, what it was in the limes or lemons or, you know, any of the citruses.
Right. But with that in mind, when you were talking about the first case where, you know, the guys coming down from the autopsies would still have the death on them and the germs. And then the one doctor wrote a paper about, you know, what we need to do is clean. Wouldn't they then, in the sense, still also think, well, you know, I mean, we don't know why the limes work, but they work, so thank God for it. What we do know is that this side of the hospital is doing fine, and the difference does seem to be that they're not dealing with dead people right before they go to live, you know, to deliver the babies or deal with the mothers.
Well, that's obvious in hindsight.
Sure.
But remember, the doctors were the smart ones. If that was true, somebody would have discovered it a long time ago.
True.
You know, and
it's just
also
so scary think that, yeah, these are our brightest minds.
Yeah.
At least as we believe them to be, and they're so clueless on so much.
Well, and arrogance, too.
Yeah.
Hello.
Well, look at the astronomers. They're my pet target, of course, because they've said so many stupid things over the years. But space travel was one. Space travel is utter bilge, said the British Astronomer Royal. Not in 1930 or 40 or 50, but in 1956. Sputnik went up in 57. And part of the complaint in 56 was nobody's ever going to spend the money. It'd be so much better to develop new instruments for astronomy. Well, no science has benefited more from the space program than astronomy. Think about it. Not only the Hubble telescope, but there's a whole bunch of other spacecraft out there. They're totally revising our picture of the universe. And, you know, smart people and all that stuff, we don't often get taught, you know what? We were all wrong about the surface of Mars, about the surface of Venus, about the temperature on Venus, that there was never any water on the moon. There's a whole bunch of these things where astronomers were totally wrong. Why? Because they didn't have any data, but it just seemed reasonable to them. And you run into this in the, some people will get mad, but I'll call it as I see it, the SETI program, S-E-T-I,
right.
Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. We've all been brainwashed. This is a great search of our time. We keep listening with our wonderful radio telescopes, and pretty soon we'll pick up a signal from another civilization somewhere else, and it will be the most exciting discovery you can imagine. And we can even calculate how many civilizations there are out there, how many planets on which there are civilizations capable of sending electromagnetic signals to us using the Drake equation. That's a funny equation. Some guys using come up with 10,000 civilizations in our galaxy. Others come up with a billion.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of an equation is that? And the kicker here, of course, is that I call it silly effort to investigate because the basic assumptions are not scientific. They assume that aliens are sending signals to us, not just broadcasting in all directions, but sending signals to us here using technology appropriate to our listening equipment. Now, we've only known about radio for a little over 100 years,
right,
roughly. And I hate to say this on a radio program, but we don't know that much about it. And yet, if we've only had it 100 years, let's say, and there are civilizations out there that are a little older than ours. Now, how much is a little older? Now, if you believe the world was created in 4004 B.C. and October 23rd at 6 p.m., nothing's very much older.
Right.
If you say, hey, that's 4 billion and 4, you missed a few zeros. Then you say, well, wait a minute. We couldn't be the last, the most advanced, the first to really get out there and learn about the universe. What if somebody else is maybe a little bit ahead of us? 100 years? 1,000? Million? That's still nothing out of 4 billion, is it?
Right.
If they're 100 years ahead of us, they're going to be using something different, and 1,000 for sure. I mean, lasers are only 50 years old. And look what we use them for all over the place. You can even knock down rockets with them, besides repairing your retina and running the internet and doing all kinds of stuff that would have seemed ludicrous. If I told you that I could have a device on my desk that can hold 300 gigabytes of data, and you say, hey, that's a small one, Stan.
Right.
But 60 years ago, you said, you're crazy. You know,
assuming if they're going in the same kind of linear time frame we are in inventing. But if so many of these stars and planetary systems that they think may sustain life are so far away, is it too, and again, I'm not in any way here trying to seem like I'm hyper intelligent, but if we're beaming our deal out there trying to listen in on radio frequencies from them, wouldn't our radio frequencies take forever to get out there, take 100 years, 200 years, 1,000 years for them to be able to pick it up in their way? And maybe we'd be just picking up now on things that they transmitted 100 years ago, 200, 300 years ago?
Oh, well, there's no question about that. And
sir,
so that's what makes it important that it's a lifetime job for a radio astronomer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll keep listening, and we'll have better receivers, and we'll keep listening. And there is no UFO evidence, they will tell you. Dr.
Seth
Shostak has said that. Joe Tartar has said that. You never see them refer to the large-scale scientific studies that I talk about. And people say, well, why not? Well, there's a simple reason. If aliens are coming here, who the heck needs SETI? Think
sure.
about it. Maybe you need to learn sign language. You know?
We have to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more with our guest, Stanton Friedman. The new book is called Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. Stanton T. Friedman and Kathleen Marden are the authors. If you'd like more information, you can also check out Stanton's website, stantonfriedman.com. That's STANTONFRIEDMAN.com. We have that link up on our website. You can go to darknessradio.com. Click on the upcoming shows link. You'll find information about our guests, about the book, and on ways to get in touch with them and see more about them from their websites. We're going to be right back. Stay tuned. You've got more of the best in paranormal talk radio coming up right after this.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You want to know what else you can do in about a minute? You can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, or do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my dreamy, creamy, dulcet tones, you can also get a true cash offer. But best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or your home. You just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Just answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring in your car, and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get all the answers you need so there's no surprises. Then, just simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today.
Good evening. Welcome back to the show. Darkness Radio, your home for the best in paranormal talk radio. Our guest this evening, Stanton Friedman, is joining us, and he has co-written a book, Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. The book is available and out on the shelves right now. Is that correct?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Excellent. Well, yeah, I want to talk, before we launch too much more into the book, just kind of curious, knowing what you know about SETI and science, coming from a paranormal investigator standpoint and dealing in ghosts and the research that we do, there's a few new tools and things that are being used with radios, EVP, different, I don't know, just these different pieces of equipment that are dealing with voices coming from somewhere. One thing that's been very strange, you know, we talk about the fact that SETI is sending out or listening for these signals to see if we're getting any messages from out there. And Seth Shostak is the gentleman in charge of SETI. There's a really strange anomaly that occurs, not just in a small pocket, but investigators from around the world report this, that when listening to these radios, these modulated or modified radios and spirit boxes, as they call them, the one name that's repeated back quite often is Seth.
Interesting.
No correlation for the location, no correlation with anything that would be taking place in that specific spot, that who would Seth be? But and it's coming from different languages, different countries, different investigative groups and techniques, but the name Seth keeps coming back. Now, I know that there was a famous book written and charts that were done by this lady that was tapping into some,
entity.
Entity that she called Seth, who was this ingenious entity who was kind of an overseer and gave her information on how to make life better for everyone. And there's books on it, and I think they're called the Seth Papers.
Okay.
It's an interesting topic, but I also wonder, you know, he's dealing with radio frequencies and they're sending out signals and waiting to hear back from other planets. Maybe he's just not modulated into the right place. If UFOs are maybe not necessarily out there, but on separate dimensions or realities or whatever, and if we're bleeding out, you know, with these messages and we're waiting for him, maybe he's focused out into the wrong area to get the messages back that he's listening for.
Well, yeah, I think he is. In the first place, I don't think aliens out there are stuck at the level of standard radio.
Right.
We're going to discover something better. I mean, I got a shock about 3 years ago. I was in Detroit and was going over how much technology has changed in the last 50 years or so. You know, not just the internet and computers, but DNA and a whole bunch of things. And I mentioned, you know, when I started working in industry, I was using a slide rule. And I looked around the class, not a bit of response. So I had guts enough and was foolish enough to have, any of you know what a slide rule is? Not one person in the class knew. And that was less than 50 years ago.
Right.
And the atom bomb was, the guys who invented it, if you will, researched it. We're using slide rules most of the time. You know, that's 50 years.
Right.
And let me give you another example. In about 1938, before the Second World War started in Europe, you know, Americans think the war started on December 7th, 1941. But for the Europeans and Canadians, it was before that by 2 years plus. And a German general, head of intelligence, had reports come to him that the English were building these tall towers, about 200 feet tall, with crossbars facing the English Channel. And he figured, aha, they're developing radar. I mean, everybody knew that we were sort of heading toward a war and that airplanes might play a role and stuff. And so he sent, would you believe, a Zeppelin to fly slowly along the English Channel, not over England now, we don't want to violate their airspace,
right?
And with all kinds of listening equipment, and they flew a long ways, and they didn't pick up one signal. Something's wrong here. We know what frequency they've got to use, they said. And they did it again. This time they wound up flying over England, and it was quite an international incident, just blown off course by the wind. Where have I heard that excuse before? But anyway, it turns out that the Brits did have radar, and they were listening to, you know, this thing flying by and all the other stuff going on. They differed by a factor of 10 in the frequency they had selected for their radar. Now, the kicker here is that English and German scientists knew each other. They went to some of the same schools. They published in the same journals. And we still, the Germans who were smart, couldn't predict the right frequency to listen to from a neighbor, you know, just down the street. Mm-hmm. And we're going to know what aliens, about whom we know nothing, are using for communication? And also, there's this strange reasoning that says, and there have been a couple of events. I just wrote an article for the Mutual UFO Network Symposium in late July about Stephen Hawking, SETI, and science. And one of the underlying assumptions is that if they were coming here, they would we'd hear from them first. And of course, Columbus sent smoke signals to the Indians before he headed west, didn't he? I mean, that's ridiculous.
Right.
We haven't picked up a signal, so there's nobody out there.
And thank God the British were on the on their ships with their microphones yelling, "We're coming over soon."
Yes.
To let us know, right?
Yeah. So what I'm getting at here is that I have found that the SETI people tend to be not very knowledgeable about human behavior. You know, they have claimed, for example, that if they get a signal, they'll make it known right away. That's so they can keep their funding going. But none of them will acknowledge that there's a national security aspect to the UFO stuff. Like, for example, if you could duplicate the flight behavior, you'd have one heck of a military flight system, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because now they can fly circles around anything we got flying, and I mean that literally.
Definitely.
And they don't seem to understand. Also, they'll tell you, and Seth Shostak this time, he's given two reasons and done two different programs for why he doesn't think governments can cover anything up. One is how fouled up FEMA was about Katrina, the hurricane, and the other was the U.S. Post Office. Now, the fact that it may or may not work well, and frankly, the U.S. works better than the Canadian, and I know about both of them.
Right.
But it can't keep secrets. How about the Lockheed stealth aircraft development?
Mm-hmm.
$10 billion and over 10 years and totally in secret. You know, the Post Office and FEMA may be interesting agencies, but how about the CIA, the DIA, the NRO, the NSA, which means never says anything, or more properly, no such agency, you know. I mean, you know, it's ludicrous to bring in these other things, which have nothing to do with whether secrets can be kept. So I try to figure out, are these guys living in the real world? And people can't imagine why aliens would come here. And Seth has asked, why now? It must be all this science fiction stuff. Come on. Our knowledge is so new. We didn't represent a threat to aliens out there until we show signs of being able to get out there. We didn't even know that there were neutrons until 1932. We figured out how the stars work, theoretically, nuclear fusion, in 1938. But, of course, we put that to use in 1952. We built our first H-bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a slight step up from dynamite. Like, the first H-bomb released as much energy as exploding 10 million tons of TNT. 10 million tons. Now, during World War II, a big bomb, and it took a big B-29 to carry it, was a 10-ton blockbuster. And our first H-bomb, which had a fireball 3 miles wide, which would have been very impressive to anybody looking down from above. It's impressive to me. I don't know.
Definitely.
Three-mile-wide fireball, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent. That's only 14 years after the theory. And I've worked on fusion, that's nuclear fusion, and I'll guarantee you that every advanced civilization is going to try to figure out how its star is producing its energy, since it obviously isn't burning gas or oil or even BP oil, you know. Well, what I'm saying is that it's very recent, and yet, from an alien viewpoint, suddenly, here are these idiot Earthlings, and I say that because we're a primitive society. Our major activity is tribal warfare. Why do I say that? Well, because in World War II, we destroyed 1,700 cities, and we killed 50 million people, and we're still going at it.
Mm-hmm.
If that isn't tribal warfare, what is it? Why aren't we feeding our starving kids? 30,000 die needlessly every single day of preventable disease or starvation. And yet, on this planet, we will spend $1 trillion plus this year on things military. So if you were an alien, wouldn't you worry about these guys? You're going to wait until they land on your doorstep and drop a bomb on you?
Exactly.
I don't think so. You know, that's why we have the NSA.
You were talking something a little bit about the scientists and Stephen Hawking, and I'm just curious what your thoughts were. I don't know. It struck me almost as funny when to hear Stephen Hawking considered to be one of the greatest minds of our time, and his big theory on aliens is that when they come here, we don't want them here because when they come here, it's going to be to destroy and take over, and he just started to map out like an episode of V or any other sci-fi movie ever made, and it just seemed like, come on, Stephen, at least have a little bit more inventive nature to your theory of what's going to happen when they come.
And that's what my paper's about, his comments about, this is the year of the media paying attention to aliens because people like Stephen have spoken out. And the Royal Institute in London had a big conference and they featured SETI. They didn't talk sensibly about UFOs. And, I have the greatest respect as a physicist myself for Stephen as an outstanding astrophysicist. But when you start talking about comparing us to the natives and the New World, and the aliens to Columbus coming as a marauder. Now, I don't know whether Columbus was a marauder or not. Maybe so. But the kicker is we are not like the natives. We do have weapons of mass destruction. We do have intercontinental ballistic missiles. We have sent men off the planet. We've got monitoring systems from the sky, from the ground, radar and spy satellites and all this stuff. We are not in the same kind of primitive society, and the natives represented no threat to the people in Europe. Their canoes wouldn't get that far, frankly. But we do represent a threat because at the rate of change of our knowledge of the universe and our discoveries of things like nuclear fusion, and I want to emphasize, 10 million times as much energy per particle, we're not stuck here forever. We have given every indication we're willing to pay lots of money to destroy. There's no secret about that. Look where our money goes. Look where our effort goes. I mean, I worked in the defense industry, so I have some idea about that. Well, I'll give you an example. When I was working on nuclear airplanes back in 1958 for General Electric, was it 6 professors and 12 grad students? No. We spent $100 million that year, employed 3,500 people, 1,100 of whom were engineers and scientists. A few years ago, I checked on the 3 nuclear weapons labs. The total budget for each one, that's Livermore and Los Alamos and Sandia, real companies, real outfits these are, their total budget for just the 3 of them was greater than the budget for the National Science Foundation for all its research stuff. So, let's be realistic about what kind of beings we are. And we had Pearl Harbor. And there's a section in the book where I talk about the fact that Billy Mitchell had said that you could sink ships from airplanes. And boy, was he laughed up and down and out of town. A sad little episode. The program for the Army-Navy football game on November 29th, 1941, had a picture of the USS Arizona, the mighty Arizona, and this enormous, powerful battleship. And there was a caption that said, "Nobody has ever sunk a battleship from the air." Mm. 8 days later, the Arizona was sunk, and 1,100 people died as a consequence. So we are a threat to anybody in the neighborhood. They'd be absolute fools to let us just do our thing and wind up on their doorstep. And you see, I make only one assumption about the aliens. I don't know what language they speak. I think they probably do have telepathy, and the book has a chapter on paranormal phenomena and stuff. But one thing I am sure of, they're concerned about their own survival and security. Everybody is. That means you got to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Only close tabs on those primitives will show signs of being able to bother you. It's a little late if the armada is on the way. And so, you know, these things are things we need to talk about and need to recognize and not be stuck. Well, I'll give you another example of the difficulty. I was interviewed for the Peter Jennings mockumentary, which was broadcast February 24th, 2005, in a museum in Roswell. And I'll be at Roswell next week for the annual festival. There'll be a big announcement about a new movie, Magic Men, which I will be involved. That'll be on July 2nd. Keep your ears open.
Will do.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood movie. And where was I going with that? I get so caught up in the Hollywood thing. You know, who's going to play me? Is it Richard Dreyfuss, maybe?
Not a bad choice.
Wouldn't that be something from Close Encounters? You know, come around.
Oh, definitely.
But the thing here is we need to be realistic about what goes on in our own society and the real ways money are spent. I was saying when I was interviewed for the Peter Jennings mockumentary, as I called it, in Roswell, at a museum, not the UFO museum. They have art museums there, too, incidentally, for those who want to come on by and say hi. It was a good interview for an hour. I've been interviewed a lot, and I ask sensible questions and stuff in a nice setting. They're wrapping it all up, and my interviewer says, Stan, don't you think if these things were real, that half the scientists at universities who would be working on UFO research stuff? Strange question. And I said, no. Those who can do, those who can't teach. You want advanced technology, you don't go to a university where it's publish or perish. You go to people who can keep secrets, who know how to mobilize a large effort. You know, the Manhattan Project to develop nuclear weapons cost $2 billion in 1942 money, which is a heck of a lot more than that now, I'll tell you. And astronomers don't get to spend that kind of money, you know. And people at universities in general don't. So what I'm saying is we need to be aware of the need for putting good thinking to use, but in a realistic kind of way. Governments can keep secrets. I worked under security for 14 years. I know that for a fact. I've been to 20 archives, and it was announced a couple months ago that there's still 400 million pages of classified material more than 25 years old in the United States. Think about that. You can't read that in a year.
Right. Unbelievable.
Well, it is unbelievable, partly because the academics just don't understand that there's a lot going on out there. I had a guy tell me if Roswell had happened, if there had been a crash of a flying saucer, there had been a paper in the Physical Review, which is where most of us physical scientists publish, within 3 months, they said. I said, you don't understand security, do you? The first nuclear chain reaction was in December 1942. You think there was a paper about it? It was an earth-shaking event. As a matter of fact, we even lied and we tested the first A-bomb in July 16th, 1945. An ammunition dump had blown up, and fortunately, nobody was injured. They had to say something because it was seen from 100 miles away.
Right.
But we lied about it. I'm not saying they shouldn't have. I'm just saying they did.
Well, and we've also now, we've painted ourselves in a corner as a country and as our leaders. If they come forward and admit, I think at this point, that yeah, we've been hiding UFOs, that's just going to totally destroy the credibility and believability that we all still want to kind of hold on to, that our government is still watching our best interest. And if we tell them now, all right, I could see them coming out and going, wow, now we've seen something and we agree to it, but we don't believe in anything before that time. You know, I just think we're in that corner that we're never going to get ourselves out of because of the credibility factor. And not only just from us, but once we start really kind of questioning it and it becomes more than just the fringe element, crying conspiracy, I think then that's when the United States is going to start to fall even faster than we're doing now.
It is a major problem. No country wants its citizens to owe their allegiance to the planet instead of that individual country. Nationalism is the only game in town. But who speaks for planet Earth? People say, why don't they land on a White House lawn? I'm sure it comes as a surprise to you that the President of the United States doesn't speak for 6.3 or 4 or 5 billion Earthlings.
Right.
He has trouble speaking for 300 million Americans.
Right, but it's the ego of our own people that think that we would be the one that they want to come talk to.
Yeah, and we'll hold an election. That's the democratic thing to do.
That's right.
Hey, wait a minute. China's got 1.3 billion and India 1 billion. No, we're not going to hold an election.
Well, Stanton, it's been a pleasure having you on. I'm sorry. I'd love to have you come back, and soon, maybe after you make your official announcement, you can come back on the show here in a couple of weeks and let us know about this big Hollywood deal that's going to go on. Would you do that?
Sure. Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C. And the website, again, is www.stantonfriedman.com. There's an interesting article on government UFO lies, which some people might find fascinating.
Oh, I'm sure they will. And Stanton, it's always a pleasure having you on, and it goes by so fast. Folks, the book is called Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. Stanton Friedman, the author, along with Kathleen Marden. Stanton, please keep in touch with us. We'll talk to you again soon, okay?
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you like our show, you're going to love AJ Benza, Fame as a Bitch, on Podcast One. Join the gossip columnist as he gives his unfiltered opinion on the biggest scandals with his insider perspective on the lives of who's who in Hollywood and tough guy demeanor. Download new episodes of Fame as a Bitch every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to Beyond the Darkness. Hope you're enjoying today's episode. Again, it's from 2010 of Darkness Radio, and it was an episode that's actually taking place over 2 days of Darkness Radio. The first day had Stanton Friedman on. The second day, or the second part of today's program you're going to hear, is with his co-author, Kathleen Marden. In the book that we're talking about, is Proof Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. Now, Kathleen will come up here in the second part of the program and talk about the 7 chapters that she wrote in the book. And, of course, Stanton wrote the first 7 chapters of the book. And, again, fascinating reading. And this weekend, we've been paying tribute to Stanton Friedman all weekend long. Unfortunately, Stanton passed away at the age of 84 in... He died suddenly, at the Toronto Pearson Airport. He was coming back from a speaking engagement in Columbus, Ohio, Monday night. And it, again, just tragic that he has passed away. Stanton did live a very full 84 years and was very passionate about his work in the ufology field. Again, he was credited with bringing the 1947 Roswell incident to light and putting it back into the mainstream conversation. That was probably his most famous achievement in the ufology field, although Stanton put a lot of things in front of us and put a lot of things on our plate and brought a lot of things to our attention. This book, Proof Science Was Wrong, The Startling Truth About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible, was one of them. And it has some fascinating information about it, and definitely one of the things that you'll want to check out. One of the things that, one of the legacies that he put in front of us that was absolutely stunningly fascinating, and you'll definitely want to pick up the book and take a look at it. Another note that I want to throw out there, Mally Fox was the co-host for this show in this time, and this was one of those times where there was a layoff at the station that I was at the time, so Mally filled in very, very, very nicely, as a matter of fact, while I was gone. And I want to mention Mally real quick. Mally does have her Paranormal Girl line going right now of clothing for the ladies out there that are in the paranormal field. And she's got some really great designs out there. So I do want to throw a quick pitch out there for her. And be sure to check out her Paranormal Girl line of clothing for the ladies out there. Go to paranormalgirl.com. Check that out. Also, Mally, myself, and Dave will all be in the same spot just one time only this year. at Michigan Paracon at the end of August. You can go get your tickets right now for that by going to darknessevents.com, clicking on the banner, and getting your tickets. You can see all three of us in the same location, which is really cool. I always look forward to that. Always look forward to the three of us being together in one spot, at least that time of year. So be sure to do that while you have your chance there. So without further ado, let's get into the second part of today's program with Kathleen Martin, talking about proof science was wrong, startling truths about cures, theories, and inventions they declared impossible. Here's the second part of that program right now, in our tribute to Stanton Friedman, dead at the age of 84.
Good evening, and you're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Along with me on the journey, we have Miss Mally Fox. Good evening, Mally.
Hello.
I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Thank you very much for joining us. And, you know, Mally, last night we got to talk to Stanton Friedman.
Yes.
On the show. Interesting guy. And talking about the new book, Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. Mm-hmm. And he co-routed. Hey, what you call that? Co-wrote it. He co-wrote the book with Kathleen Martin. And this evening we're going to be speaking with Kathleen on the show. And Kathleen's very interesting. She wrote seven of the chapters. Stanton wrote the other seven chapters.
Okay.
And we're going to talk to her about the chapters she worked on this evening. And then we're going to have Kathleen back tomorrow night.
Really?
We are. She is. She also co-authored a book with Stanton Friedman about Betty and Barney Hill.
Okay.
And, you know, probably the most famous UFO abduction case in history.
See, no, I've never heard of them.
Really?
Yeah, well, you know me, though. I'm just now learning about UFO stuff.
Yeah, so we've got, we're going to talk to Kathleen, and she's actually the niece of Betty and Barney Hill.
Oh, okay.
And she's had the opportunity to actually hear these tapes and hear what happened and how it affected their lives. So we're going to talk with Kathleen about that. Let's get to the show tonight, though. This is pretty exciting stuff. I'm very excited to have her join us this evening. Again, our guest is Kathleen Martin, and she was trained as a social scientist and educator. For 10 years, she served as the International Director of Field Investigator Training for the Mutual UFO Network. She's a co-author of Captured. Martin has appeared in many television documentaries and radio programs and lectured throughout the United States. She has a new book that is co-authored by Stanton Friedman, and the name of the book, Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, it is our pleasure. We had a great chance to talk with Stanton, who we've had on the show in the past, and wanted to just kind of go around on this, because I know that he wrote seven of the chapters. Is that right? You wrote the other seven chapters?
Yes, that's correct.
And he, of course, has a heavy slant towards the UFOs, and certainly like to talk about that, as anybody that listened last night got a chance to hear. And I just wanted to kind of get into some of the other issues in the book that that were so interesting. Now, this is, I think, first of all, a fascinating book, and it is available, and it's out there on sale right now, folks. Again, Science Was Wrong is the main title, written by Kathleen Martin, M-A-R-D-E-N, and Stanton Friedman. So you can check that out on Amazon.com. Let's talk about some of the different things that you wrote about in the book that you were involved with. In your book, you have a chapter titled Politics, Personalities, and Childbed Fever. Can you tell us a little bit about the childbed fever and why you wrote about that?
Yes. Back in the 19th century, women were dying at a tremendous rate from childbed fever. And it was a time when Ignaz Semmelweis, was a young doctor in Vienna. He was born in 1818 and he died in 1865. He actually grew up in Pest in Hungary. And after graduating from medical school, he taught medical students at the Vienna General Hospital. He was able to secure a job there. And what he observed when he was there is that entire rows of women would succumb to this terrible raging fever and infection that would strike them up to 2 weeks after they gave birth. And their infants also often died of the same symptoms. Now, there were two units, obstetrical units at the hospital. One was the midwifery unit, where it was mostly women in there, who nurses or midwives, and they had only a 2% mortality rate. But then there was the obstetrical unit, and this was where the male medical students worked, and their rate was at 20%. And oftentimes, at different times of the year, the mortality rate would climb above 20% in the unit where the men worked. Well, Dr. Semmelweis was really trying to figure out what was causing that. There were all sorts of theories going around in those days that it was miasmas caused by putrid smells in the atmosphere, or that women were just so frightened by the prospect of giving childbirth that they developed this terrible infection and died. There was another theory, a milk metastasis theory, that the milk from the mammary glands sort of reversed direction, went down into the uterus, and when they dissected these women, they thought that the pus that they saw was actually clotted milk. So there were all of these, you know, theories that sound very, very strange to us today, but they believed in back then. It was quite by accident that Dr. Semmelweis found out what was causing this. Every morning, he would lead his students to the mortuary for instruction on dissection of the deceased postpartum patients that had died the day before. And by accident, one of his colleagues pricked his finger on a scalpel when he was dissecting one of these women. And he developed all of the symptoms of childbed fever and died. Now, that clued Dr. Semmelweis that something was wrong. And he realized that none of his students washed their hands. They went from the room where they dissected these women, just they wiped their hands on their dirty aprons, and then they went into the obstetrical unit and did internal examinations on whole rows of women never washing their hands. So Dr. Semmelweis introduced a simple solution, hand washing. And he used chlorinated lime solution and a nail brush, and he told each student that before they entered that division, they had to wash their hands. And he kept a careful record, and the mortality rates dropped dramatically with the hand-washing procedure. But his supervisor was convinced that it was one of those other causes that I just talked about and had nothing to do with hand-washing. After all, a doctor's hands were meant to heal. How could they possibly be killing the women on that ward?
Now, Kathleen, tell me again, what year is this taking place?
Okay, this is taking place in about the 1840s.
Okay. All right, so again, they're and I know Stanton kind of touched a little bit on the story last night. They're just, at this point, not capturing the idea that germs are passed by touching things, sneezing in your hand, coughing, and germs like that. It's almost like magic to them how these things occur, how these diseases are being spread.
That is correct. It's before Louis Pasteur, before the discovery of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were all sorts of theories floating around. Dr. Semmelweis, for his discovery and for what he introduced, was actually fired from his job. And during his entire career, although he did very good work as a scientist, testing his hypothesis in laboratories, keeping very good records, was never recognized. In fact, he was debunked throughout Europe. He was called a charlatan, and he was sort of forced to go back to Hungary to work in a hospital there, where he also introduced the hand-washing procedure. It wasn't well received at first, but it finally was. But during his entire lifetime, it was a tremendous struggle, and his discovery was not recognized until years after his death. The happy story at the end is that he was finally recognized, and that Austria now has a stamp with his photograph on it with his picture on it. The medical school in Hungary is named after him. So he was correct, but he had this horrible struggle and the sense of shame brought upon him during his entire career.
That's unbelievable. And, yeah, you would think that would have just been a common sense type thing. You know, I guess that's easy to say with 21st century understanding and knowledge. But again, just the fact that, wow, this person's dead and I've got their blood on my hands and they died of some unknown disease, you'd think it would just be like, yeah, let's get this off of us anyway. But that they would just wipe them off on the aprons and move on to the next body is unbelievable.
Yes.
Now, let me ask you this. With the work that you guys did on the book, why do you think that it's so difficult to advance new sound scientific ideas and discoveries? You know, I know that we work in the paranormal field and investigate ghosts and claims of ghosts and the paranormal that way. And even though there are some things that have very sound background and we understand this, and, you know, even to the idea of, okay, we're picking up EVP, electronic voice phenomenon, it seems to be heard in this spectrum, in this frequency, and we're trying to tune in, you know, like radios and equipment to try to pinpoint those frequencies to see if we can better the communication. And it makes sense scientifically, but yet the field of science stands back and goes, you're nuts. This is a waste of time. And you know, it's like fringe thinkers and engineers and scientists that are starting to work on this. Why do you think it's so hard to advance new scientific ideas and discoveries like that?
Well, I think, first of all, scientific methodology is naturally conservative. And in a sense, that's good. But it's extremely difficult for scientists, in a sense, to admit that their life's work was wrong. Our scientific theory is based upon Western materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of, for example, ghost hunting or psi phenomena or even UFOs, those sorts of things don't fit into those Western materialistic paradigms.
Right.
And I think that creates an obstacle in itself, because for a scientist, unless they're a theoretical physicist talking about quantum theory, for the average Western scientist, this is beyond what is acceptable, what is conceivable within that scientific model.
Talking about a conspiracy theory kind of background, Kathleen, do you think that, you know, I mean, a lot of people believe that the cure for cancer already exists, the cure for the common cold exists, but there's more money in the medical field to not fix these problems. So that's why we turn a blind eye to those, or we keep it suppressed. Do you believe that there's any realism to that, or is it just a crazy fringe that believe that?
I don't know. I haven't seen evidence one way or the other on that. Maybe I'll research that for my next book. But I don't like to guess, and I base what I say upon the evidence that mm-hmm. I find.
Well, I just ask that with the thought, like we were talking with this fact that it's all based on Western materialism. That's what I was wondering is, do you think the money has a big play in it? Why we're not so, you know, we'd much rather come up with a new pill to fix the symptom than actually fix the problem.
Well, yeah, I think that certainly there is a financial aspect to it. There's also a political aspect to some of this, such as UFOs. There would be a lot of political opposition to the disclosure that UFOs are real. And so, you know, that wouldn't be acceptable. I think that probably in order to make that disclosure, every country in the world and every military in every country would have to say that UFOs are not a threat. And I think it's extremely difficult because we know that they are so much more advanced than we are. We simply don't have that kind of technology. We don't have the military hardware in order to be able to protect our world from an invading force. Now, in terms of the military, the way the military thinks, they would think about this in terms of being an invading force. So I think that there's a political motivation for denying the existence of UFOs, very much so.
Sure.
You know, and I think that, well, it's multifaceted. There are so many reasons. For a scientist to even look at the evidence that UFOs are real, say it's somebody from SETI who has spent their life looking, sending radio waves out, mm-hmm. radio signals, looking for life on another planet and another star system. Well, for them to look at the UFO evidence and to see that this is real would, in a sense, destroy their life's work and put them out of a job if they were to find that we're already being visited.
Right. Well, so you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just...
So you think that's what's
going to go ahead?
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I think that would kill a lot of people's careers, you know, if they mm-hmm. if they agreed that it's already there. Because then, if it's already there, we don't need you to watch the skies and test for these ideas anymore. You know, you did a lot more of the medical stuff, it seems, in the book as well, and I want to touch on a little bit more of that as well. Because one of the things I'd never heard about was the hemophilia holocaust. I mean, it sounds horrifying. Can you tell us a little bit about it and what caused the holocaust among the hemophiliacs?
Well, yes, I can. The hemophilia holocaust was caused by factor 8 concentrate, and that was a blood product used to treat bleeding episodes in hemophiliacs. And a couple of little bottles of this factor 8 concentrate contained hundreds of units of blood that were all produced in a large vat. And there was a filter that filtered out bacteria, but it wouldn't filter out viruses. And the blood banks for a long, long time would not admit that the blood was contaminated with HIV.
Hmm.
So there was a little bit of a greed factor, I think, in that as well. So it was a mistake, and it was, in a sense, political. There was a lot of politics involved in all of this. And there was the drug companies simply didn't want to look anyplace else for anything that would replace factor 8 concentrate. It was there, it was effective, and they said that the chance that someone with hemophilia would get HIV from this was one chance in a million. Well, in reality, one in 10,000 Americans with hemophilia became HIV positive, and 90% of factor 8 concentrate users developed HIV.
Wow. And this is something we're just talking about from the 1980s. This isn't the 1840s like our first story talking about the childbed fever. This is something, again, we should have figured out long into this, and we're in now 1980s trying to treat this, and we're not realizing the correlation and how this is all affecting. And when did they start to realize, oh, boy.
Yeah, how many years?
Well, it took several years. It was about 8 years, I believe, from the time that people started first to exhibit the symptoms. The first AIDS patients mm-hmm. started to exhibit the symptoms, and they found out what this was all about. In fact, there were two researchers from the Louis Pasteur Institute in France, Luc Montagnier and François Barre. And they were on to something in their research with this and attempted to publish in the United States on their findings, and their paper was rejected. And that's another reason, I think, that scientific ideas and discoveries are not advanced as rapidly as they should be, because peer-reviewed journals often reject information. It tends to be highly political, what gets published and what doesn't. It wasn't until Robert Gallo's laboratory at the National Cancer Institute received samples from the French that he started talking to them. They mentioned to him that they had attempted to publish about their findings and that their article was rejected. And he worked with them, writing an article jointly with them, and that was published. And I believe it was because of his political influence in doing this. So it was published, and finally the French team did discover the virus. They were able to replicate the virus, and then there was a huge political war, in a sense, over this between France and the United States, because Robert Gallo's team also produced this virus. And there was who was the first person? Who was the first team to produce this virus, to replicate this virus in a laboratory? And Margaret Heckler from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced that it was Gallo's team. Well, the sample that Gallo used ended up being linked to the Frenchman that the French team had taken the virus sample from. So there was either intentional or it was a mistake in the laboratory. Something happened in the U.S. laboratory, and they ended up having the French sample. So it was actually Montagnier and Barr who actually discovered the HIV virus. And in the end, in 2008, they were awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for discovering the cause of AIDS.
Unbelievable. Hmm. Do you think it's kind of frightening that even in the 80s and 90s, we were still so far behind in medical understanding that something that tragic could take place? That did you say one in every 10,000 people were getting the AIDS virus from this?
No, I said that 10,000 Americans with hemophilia developed HIV.
Okay, from this...
from the blood product.
Right, from the blood product.
That they used to treat their bleeding episodes with. Hmm. And 90% of the people who used that factor VIII concentrate as a blood product to treat their hemophilia bleeding episodes became HIV positive.
That's just unbelievable to me.
Were they ever compensated for getting HIV?
Well, yes, it took a long time, and there were many legal battles. I talk about one case in my book where a man who developed it did apply for the benefits, for compensation, and he was initially denied because he was told that because he had a tattoo, he must have gotten HIV from having that tattoo. There was so much denial.
Mm-hmm. Actor Paul Michael Glaser, wasn't his wife, Elizabeth Glaser, one of the people that was afflicted with this? I thought she had the hemophilia, and I thought that's how she ended up getting the issues with AIDS and passed it on to their son as well.
Usually it is possible for a woman to have hemophilia, but I'm not aware of any women who ever have. It's generally carried on the female side to their sons.
Okay. Well, I thought it was hemophilia she was dealing with that.
Yeah, I thought it was a blood transfusion, but it could have been.
Yeah, it could be.
Well, could have been just a blood transfusion.
Right.
A lot of people contracted AIDS through drug transfusions.
Well, now let's talk about the eugenics movement in America. For our listeners that aren't familiar, can you explain the eugenics movement? And then you seem very passionate about that in the book, and I'd like to know a little bit more about this from your point of view.
Yes. The eugenics movement in America was an outgrowth of social Darwinism, and it was carried by Sir Francis Galton, who was Charles Darwin's cousin, the idea was carried to the United States. And Harry Laughlin in the United States sort of latched on to this idea. But Sir Francis Galton just was attempting to promote the idea that we should do the best we can to improve ourselves and our stock, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Laughlin put a negative spin on this, and he felt that what we should do is selectively breed human beings just as we do farm animals and just as we do in producing better plants from seeds. And he carried this to the American Breeders Association subcommittee in 1909. And this started a movement in the United States. The idea was to sterilize the lower 10% of families, the lower 10% on the economic scale. And they targeted individuals who were very different from themselves. These were some of the upper-class families in the United States. And this movement was funded by some of America's wealthiest families. They wanted to eliminate the mentally ill,
sure,
the criminal elements, people who are not able to support themselves. They wanted to sterilize anyone who had any physical disability, whether they were deaf, they were blind, they had epilepsy, for example. There were a host of reasons. Alcoholism was another one. So that anyone who had any disability would be prevented from reproducing and carrying on what they called germplasm. And the movement initially didn't gain a lot of support. But through the American Breeders Association, it was carried to fairs, across, county fairs across the United States through fitter family contests and better baby contests. And at these contests, people filled out family trees, and they competed for who had the best bred family, whose family was the most productive, the best looking, the best athletes, and that sort of thing. And the winner received a silver chalice. So everybody would strive to be like that. Now, it became even worse when Harry Laughlin took over the administration and hired a group of social workers. And these social workers went out across the United States also making family trees on families that were identified as being on the lower end of the economic scale or was somehow troublesome in their communities. And it was finally carried in the end to Germany, and it gained, that movement gained a lot of popularity in Germany. And Rockefeller Money funded Joseph Mengele's experiments in the beginning before Hitler came into power. And the American Eugenics Association lamented that Germany was beating them at their own game. In America, they wanted to sterilize 15 million people over two generations. Germany ended up sterilizing and murdering many more than that. But it was carried from the United States to Germany through Harry Laughlin. And Germany adopted his model sterilization plan, and they even awarded him an honorary doctorate from Heidelberg University. This was a real insidious plan because many people in this country were sterilized involuntarily. and because there was a movement to prevent the immigration of certain groups of people from Europe who wanted to come to the United States. At Ellis Island, they were given IQ tests.
Mm-hmm.
Although they didn't speak English or didn't speak English well, the IQ tests were administered in English.
Right, that's what Stanton mentioned last night. Yeah, so here they are giving it, and if you didn't answer correctly, they thought you were a goof, and you were ones that got sterilized and separated
out.
Yes,
and I don't know if he mentioned it or not, but the questions might ask, what is the location of the five top colleges in the United States? What color are certain gemstones? So you can see this was a very biased IQ test to begin with. And people were being labeled feeble-minded or being denied access because they failed these IQ exams. Now, being feeble-minded was good cause for sterilization. And there was no specific definition for what it meant to be feeble-minded. Almost anyone could be put into that category.
I think you're talking to two of them, Kathleen.
Yeah, I know, exactly. I'm like, I don't think I would have been let into the country.
Yeah, we wouldn't have done so well. Our guest this evening is Kathleen Martin, and she is the co-author of a book, Science Was Wrong. And this is about startling truths about cures, theories, and inventions they declared impossible, co-written with Stanton Friedman. You can get more information from Kathleen and about Kathleen and her books by visiting her website, Kathleen-Marden.com. That's M-A-R-D-E-N, and Kathleen, K-A-T-H-L-E-E-N-Marden.com. Now, you also have, is it a blog page or KathleenMarden.googlepages.com? Is that another site for you?
That was my old site.
Oh, okay. Right. So
if you type that in, you'll just come up with my new site.
Excellent. Well, check it out, folks. And I want to cover some of the UFO stuff that you cover in this book as well. And I'm curious now, with what you know, if you took your aunt and uncle out of the equation, Kathleen, do you believe that we are being visited by aliens?
Yes, you'd never heard that there is evidence in support of the idea that some people have been abducted. I'm not saying that everyone who thinks they have been or everyone who claims that they've been abducted has been, but I do believe that at least some people have been abducted.
Now, out of the many claims, I mean, there seems to be more and more popping up, and I'm sure working for MUFON as you did as a field investigator and training field investigators, and then the background that you had with Betty and Barney, how many stories do you hear of these abductions? And out of the 1,000 stories you actually hear, how many do you believe to be a real case scenario?
A small percentage. I have interviewed many, many people who think they have been abducted. And many of these people seem quite clearly to fit into the category of individuals who are having hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucinations with sleep paralysis. They have never observed a UFO or had a close encounter with a UFO. They have no conscious recollection of ever seeing an alien. They have no physical evidence that anything has happened to them, but they have had this bedroom experience where they've been sleeping and they thought that they might have been abducted. They thought that there might have been a light in their room. They awoke and saw maybe an image at the foot of their bed, but this is pretty consistent with people who are actually having hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucinations. But there are other people, and let me tell you, there are a full 30% of suspected abductees who recall the entire experience without hypnosis. So they don't fit nicely into the sleep anomaly or fantasy-prone personality group. And 40% of all abductees actually have had a close encounter with the craft, and maybe a percentage of that have actually observed the non-human entities on board the craft before the abduction began. And often when there is an abduction, first, maybe the first time it's from their car, or maybe they were camping or fishing out in the woods when they were abducted. But after that, other abductions might happen from their homes and from their bedrooms. But what I have found is it's generally preceded by this first incident where they are actually out in the environment. Now, some of these people have even been missing and actively being sought after. They are gone. And there's no other explanation that we've been able to come up with, particularly when there's physical evidence and there are witnesses to this as well.
The stories are unbelievable and amazing. And again, we're going to talk more in depth tomorrow night with our guest, Kathleen Martin. The true story of the world's first documented alien abduction, Captured is the name of the book, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, that she co-wrote with Stanton Friedman. I wanted to give people a little taste of that and some of the stories that you've gathered, but I'd like to talk a little bit more about this book as well. Section 5 of your book that's out right now, entitled Science Was Wrong, Section 5 of the book has three chapters under the heading Frontiers of Science. We've got about 6 minutes left in tonight's show. What are some of the exciting new sciences that you see?
Well, I've talked in this book about psi phenomena, about the university studies that have been going on for over 100 years, and the evidence that some psi phenomena are real. There have been independent replication of controlled experiments performed thousands of times by researchers around the world. And there has been statistical evidence in support of psi phenomena from this. So it does appear to be a reality. And I'm talking about controlled experiments where there is no human face-to-face interaction going on. And you'll read in my book about the Ganzfeld telepathy experiments that took place between 1974 and 1997. There were actually 2,549 Ganzfeld sessions held around the world. And these were tightly controlled experiments. Initially, these telepathy experiments were criticized by skeptics, some of the top skeptics in the field of psychology. And the parapsychologists invited them into their laboratory to help them to develop more stringent standards so that there wouldn't be a human factor there. We wouldn't have these variables that might skew the results. So these are very, very tightly controlled experiments, and they do indicate that telepathy is real.
Unbelievable. That, to me, is exciting when science is starting to find these breakthroughs and they're bringing it out. With telepathy and what you understand and from the research you've done, how far out do you think we are before that's something that'll be a more recognized, I don't even know, what do you want to say, science or recognized phenomena?
You know, it's very hard to say because there is a lot of bias against this. And even this was taken before the National Academy of Sciences in 1987. The committee concluded that parapsychology deserves a fair hearing across a broader spectrum of the scientific community so that emotionality does not impede the objective assessment of experimental results. So even at the National Academy of Sciences, a team of scientists who were evaluating these psi results ended up producing a biased conclusion, and then were taken to task about it, and that statement that I just read to you was issued. So, again, I'm talking about Western scientific materialism.
Mm-hmm.
it, with Western scientific materialism, telepathy is impossible. We don't have an explanation for that, how that happens.
You know, and I find it so funny, too,
you know,
Kathleen.
It's going to take a paradigm shift.
Right. And I think it's kind of coming from the ghosty perspective, too. A lot of the people that are investigating ghosts and that phenomena is starting to realize that we may be having more of an effect on our equipment, even the recording devices, using forms of telepathy or manipulation to give off these false positives and false readings, and we may be somehow imprinting it. And a lot more seem to be of that mind than believing that there's actual ghosts that are influencing our equipment.
Yes, and that, you've probably heard of Occam's razor.
Right.
And Occam's razor is a theoretical construct that demands that scientists accept the simplest possible theoretical explanation for the existing data. So what are you going to say? Are you going to go through an entire paradigm shift and say that this, we have a whole new set of ideas about this? Or are we going to say, oh, it's just the human factor? You can just flush it away by saying, oh, it's a human factor. It's a human variable here. And then you don't have to take a serious look at what's going on. You don't have to change your scientific theories.
We've got about a minute left here. I know this is a power-packed question, but can you kind of sum up why you feel this book is so important?
I think this book, Science Was Wrong, is so important because it gives the general public some insight in how science works. And the obstructions to scientific progress and how scientific progress in the end oftentimes is made. But there are terrible obstacles in the way of all of this. And I think that a lot of people aren't aware of these obstacles. They think that if something is real, then science would accept it as being real. But as we know, that's not always the case.
That is true. Well, Kathleen, I want to thank you very much for spending your evening here with us. We'll talk to you again tomorrow night, and we'll talk about the other book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill story, because that's an amazing story as well. Thank you again. Much success with the new book.
Thank you.
Again, the name of the book, folks, is Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. The book is out and available right now. Thank you for tuning in. Remember, we'll be back again tomorrow night.
And there you go, folks. That was Kathleen Martin and the second part of today's program. I want to thank you guys for tuning in to this weekend's tributes to Stanton Friedman, again, dead at age 84. Want to reiterate a couple of things that I expounded on yesterday about Stanton. Again, not only just a great man, but a great leader in the field of ufology. And can't stress enough how much we're going to miss Stanton. He was a great guest for us on Darkness Radio and Beyond the Darkness. A great friend to our program as well. A great friend to the field in general of the paranormal. And really a great friend to anybody who wanted to come up and talk to him about ufology and about the paranormal in general. Stanton was extremely giving of his time, an extremely nice man who really had a passion for this field of the paranormal. It's going to be hard to have anybody try to step into those shoes. Stanton was incredibly brilliant, incredibly hardworking, and had a brilliant mind and passion for the field, and it's hard to put those together these days or find someone to put those together and want to go forward and pursue this work and try to find answers and even skeptical answers and common sense answers for those of us who thirst for that knowledge, and to do it without an ego or a television show or a thirst for fame. Stanton really never did it because he wanted to put his face out there. He did it because he just sought out the truth. And that's admirable. And in his passing, it truly is sad that before he passed away, we never really got UFO disclosure, and we never really did get any of the true answers I think I think Stanton would have publicly liked, although I think he found some of the answers, maybe privately, that or was at least happy with some of the answers he found that, you know, he could be at rest with. I truly do hope that, you know, whatever your belief system is, I hope that in my belief system, when Stanton passed, that those answers were given to him and that he truly is at peace with whatever his research was, you know, found at the end, and that he was given the answers he was looking for his entire life, and everything is at peace, and he can move on in his journey and find new answers to new questions. I'm truly going to miss him. I had many great conversations with Stanton Friedman over the years, and truly was no one like him. And I look forward to the people that will step forward and continue his work. I look forward to talking to them, and I look forward to seeing that type of passion coming forward from them in the years to come, and seeing what kind of answers they can culminate in Stanton's place. Stanton Friedman, Godspeed, and God bless you, and thank you for everything that you've done for the field of ufology and the field of the paranormal. To everyone listening right now, just remember to, again, keep your loved ones close to you. Enjoy the time that you have here. Stay passionate, stay hungry, and keep looking for answers. Don't ever stop. Don't ever stop and think that you can be complacent and that it's just the same old stuff over and over again. Keep looking for and striving for new things, new territories, and new answers to old questions, because the minute you stop learning is the minute you're done. And we never want to stop learning in this field of the paranormal. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. We'll see you next weekend right here on the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.